Hello, Akiko.
Hello.
This is the Nevada Voice podcast, and I'm sitting here with my co-host, Akiko Cooks. We're going to be talking about race, and I want to talk about why we're here, what this podcast is about, and how we sort of stumbled upon this. So your history first. How did you get you're a mom.
I'm a mom.
And yes. Suddenly you are thrust into the middle of talking about race in CCSD schools. Talk to me about what happened.
So my son and eight other black boys were targeted to be shot and killed at Arborview High School in Las Vegas, Nevada. And it was through an Instagram post that was titled Arborview N-word. Mm. Each boy was pictured separately, so there was a picture of each boy with a caption underneath, and each caption read something different. I'm going to go Columbine Part 2, but only killing the N-word. I want to cleanse the hallways of these N-words, these monkeys, these rodents. They grow bigger by the day. I can just smell the melanin dripping off of them. So each child had their own threat / comment or post. I saw it Monday night, which was March 18th, 2019. It was sent to me by a family member. And I immediately sprang into action as far as how do I protect these children and how do I get justice for them? I made some phone calls. Activism is not new for me. But I didn't see myself here today. Mm. I didn't see myself doing everything that I have done since March. Now, I'm not alone. You know, there were eight other mothers who were present and active, but people have to go on with their lives. I just decided to make this a part of mine. And there's one other mother who's still very active in it. So we're here and we're still fighting for these children because racism is still happening in the school district. We hear about it every day.
So that's where I kind of come in.
Yes, there
like,
you go.
Right? Like we're going to be talking to Pete Simme in a moment. Pete is a white nationalist expert. And one of the things I want to talk to him about is how we sort of normalize white supremacy. Yes. And I saw this. Yes. I've seen this in Facebook groups, and which is where I spend a lot of my time. Mm-hmm. I've seen it a little bit on Twitter, but honestly, not so much on Twitter, because generally somebody says something racist on Twitter, and a bunch of people just shut them down.
Yes, I think we call that Black Twitter.
Right, exactly. I mean, there's there are groups. There's a couple of teachers groups, and in one of them there was something posted that said, "Parents, please don't send your kids to school with $200 shoes and no school supplies." This was at the very beginning of school, and I saw that and thought, "That's racist," mm-hmm. because $200 pairs of shoes, Air Jordans, those kinds of things are often associated with black teenagers, teenage boys mostly. But I don't know that much about it.
Yes.
So I didn't really, I couldn't go in and go, hey, that post is racist.
You
right?
knew what he was talking about.
I knew what he was talking about. That's the thing, right? That's the, you know, we think that we are not communicating anything unless we say it directly, unless we say the N-word.
Right.
But when we sort of like whistle the N-word, like nobody, I didn't see that. I don't know if that's not. But it seemed totally racist to me. But I backed off because I was tired and I didn't particularly want to do the research that would be required of that,
right?
There were people, and to be fair, there mm-hmm. were teachers who came up and said, you know, you need to read this book, Teaching with Poverty in Mind. You need to read this book. We need to look at this. This is what privilege is, what have you.
When you're dealing with people in lower economical mm-hmm. areas, a lot of the times things are hand-me-downs. You have a lot of community programs that donate.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of shoe stores that donate to the community.
Right.
Because you will have kids in very expensive shoes and not have school supplies.
Mm-hmm.
But you never know what a person's situation is or how they got them. again, you have community members or community partners. Every summer I see it where people who own shoe stores will donate shoes to kids because they don't want to get bullied when they go to school because they don't have on the new pair of shoes. Mm-hmm. Now, should fashion be the focus? No. But kids get bullied for not looking cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have to look at school supplies and what's needed in school when in actuality it's the public school system and the school should have the school supplies that are needed for kids.
Right.
Paper, pencils. I thought that schools were supposed to offer that.
So that was part of my thing too.
Sorry.
Like I don't think when my kids started school, we were in Illinois, yeah. we were in Chicago, and I was like, wait a second, I have to pay?
Right.
This is public school. I didn't realize I had to pay.
Right.
So I think there are a lot of parents who just don't realize they have to pay.
Right.
But I want to get to the how that particular thing was racist when he posted that $200 pair of shoes, who he was referring to, how I knew that internally.
How you knew it or how everyone knew that?
How everyone knew it.
Well, because we know that Jordan tennis shoes are a black boy thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody might have a pair of Jordan tennis shoes, basketball players, athletes. But generally in high school, junior high, it's black boys that are wearing Jordans.
Mm-hmm.
So we know who you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
He just didn't want to say, hey, black moms.
Right.
He just didn't want to say that. So he passively aggressively said it. And you picked up on it because you pay attention to it. Some other teachers agreed. And some teachers said, hey, that's not cool.
Yeah. Some teachers said, hey, that's not cool.
Yeah.
But there was one teacher who then said something about girls coming to school with manicured with nice. And he wrote breaded. He meant to write beaded mm-hmm. hair and Jordan shoes, but without pencils and crayons. And then there was another teacher who made a joke about, what's breaded hair? I've never seen that. Ha, ha, ha. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, that totally was racist. Like, I'm not backing off now. That was totally racist. That was more than a whistle.
I'm so glad
you
wasn't
were
there.
Talking about black girls. Like, that's, and then that other teacher who made the joke started calling me delusional because I called it racist.
So,
and that's when I realized, oh my God, we've got a problem with teachers in school who don't recognize what's going on in front of them.
Again, actually, the public school system is supposed to supply school supplies, pencils and crayons and paper. Second of all, that's cultural for us, our hair. And a lot of the times, the mom is doing the hair right there in the living room. You sit down in the living room and you sit down in between your mom's legs and she braids your hair and puts the beads on. Or there's a neighborhood aunt or something like that. But because education is not happening for teachers or they're not having cultural diversity or cultural sensitivity classes or anything about our culture, they don't know that that's how it gets done. We don't go generally as a child to a shop and get our hair braided.
Mm-hmm.
We don't pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the times before school, there are braiders who are doing back to school specials. They'll pick 25 girls and braid their hair for free so that they get back to school confident about what they look like. So to assume that a black child's parents is spending more money on their appearance than their school supplies is racist.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty racist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unfair, especially when you haven't taken the time to get to know this student or to even understand what our culture is. I know the difference between a perm and a relaxer. Black people don't get.
I do not.
We get relaxers to straighten our hair.
Okay. Okay.
We don't.
And
get
white
perms.
People get perms
Correct.
To curl their hair. Okay. Okay.
But
I
a lot
that.
Of teachers don't know that because they haven't taken the time to figure out culturally. You're teaching children that have different types of hair. Like we have 1C, 2C, 4C. Like my hair is a 4C texture.
I know nothing about that. That's something I want to learn about.
Right.
You mentioned that at one point the other day,
yeah.
and I was like, whoa, okay, I got to look that up. Okay.
And because you want to know.
I do want to know.
It's a lot of teachers who don't. And is it your job to want to know? I don't know. But
wait a second, though. If you are a teacher
mm-hmm.
in Las Vegas
yes.
Most of the kids you teach are black or brown people.
Yes.
There are more black and brown kids in Clark County School District than white kids.
Yes.
Then you have to know those cultural things.
Yes.
That is my view of it.
Yes.
Now,
I
get that teachers are overwhelmed.
Yes, I do too.
I get that they're underpaid. I get that they work 12 hours a day.
Right.
And in many instances, it takes a toll on teachers when they're working in poorer communities.
Yes, it does.
It takes an emotional toll. I get that. But the people who generally are working in the poorer communities and have that emotional reaction get it.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Right? That's why they have that emotional reaction.
Right.
But I feel like if you don't understand those cultural things, then you're missing something very fundamental as a teacher.
Very much so. And it can be detrimental to the relationship or the rapport that you can or cannot build with the student.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw a picture of, he was a white teacher, and one of his students did his edges, and he took a picture and sent it to his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So his daughter posted it, and she's like, oh my God, I just fell out. My dad just sent me a picture that one of his students did his edges. I knew that that was a little black girl that did his edges. But what it said to me looking at the picture was that this teacher has a rapport built with his students because she took her toothbrush, because that's what we use, is a little hair toothbrush to do the edges. And she laid his hair down, his baby hair down on the side of his head. And he took a picture like he's built a rapport with his students.
Mm-hmm.
His students trust him, which means that they'll probably do better in class. They'll want to do better for him. Because he genuinely cares. I won't say that there are no teachers who don't care. I know a few who care personally, who really, really care. But then you do have some who don't, and they don't need to be in the classroom. If you're burnt out, find another position. No teacher becomes a teacher to be rich. They know what they're going to make. They become a teacher to care. They become a teacher because they care and they want to educate. But you have to want to educate everyone. You can't just want to educate a student that looks like you.
Okay. So we're going to be talking about this and exploring this once a month on the podcast also once a month as we're doing these town hall forums, the People's Voice forums that we're going to be doing in various neighborhoods where we're going to be talking about social issues, including racism and including homophobia and, issues like issues of white supremacy, issues of sexism and misogyny and how they all intersect and how you can be a victim and also an oppressor at the same time.
Yes.
It's the Nevada Voice podcast. I'm Carrie Kaufman, sitting here with my co-host, Akiko Cooks. We're going to bring in Pete Simme. He is a professor of sociology at Chapman University and author of American Swastika, Inside the White Power Movement's Hidden Spaces of Hate. Pete, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So talk to me about how you know each other.
Yeah, so we initially connected over the radio, NPR Nevada. They were covering, the incident at the high school that her son was unfortunately targeted in terms of the white supremacist Instagram account. And so they had myself and a person from the Anti-Defamation League and Kiko and one other person who I'm totally forgetting, but talking about the problem of the resurgence of white supremacist groups and hate groups in the United States and how, her individual experience kind of fits into this larger a trend. So then after that experience of being on the radio with her, we hadn't met in person, but I was just so moved to hear her, not only her personal experience, but also how she spoke about the issue more broadly.
Mm-hmm.
I reached out to her over email and asked if, we could start a kind of conversation of sorts. And then I'm part of a effort that's being supported by the Southern Poverty Law Center to try and develop some pilot programs in potentially in schools or maybe not in schools, but something that would be directed at trying to reduce right-wing extremism among youth in our country.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had an initial meeting last spring, and then we were having another meeting this fall, and wanted her to be part of that second meeting.
And you were there to talk about how young people get pulled into white supremacy, yes?
Yeah, so this was a meeting in D.C. hosted by American University, and one of my colleagues, Cynthia Miller Idris, who's a sociologist as well, who studies the white supremacist movement, and her and I have been working together on a project that's being supported by the Southern Poverty Law Center to start hosting a series of kind of dialogues to start talking about how we can potentially plan programs that might be effective at trying to reduce the amount of radicalization among youth, especially in regards to white supremacist radicalization. So the meeting, we wanted individuals from different backgrounds, different perspectives, to be able to come together and have this kind of a conversation. And so, having been on the radio with Akiko, I immediately, you know, when I was talking with Cynthia about planning this event, immediately thought of her and was really moved by not only her personal experience, but also by her perspective and knowledge about the white supremacist movement and historical kind of development of the movement and the extent to which it's, you know, really continued to be a major presence in our society, but we've kind of denied and minimized that. And now more recently, unfortunately, because of incidents that, you know, her family's gone through, people are starting to pay a little bit more attention to it. We should have been paying attention to it much sooner, much earlier. So now we're starting to have these conversations, and I think it's really important that we think about how to try and target youth in particular as far as to help them kind of be more resilient and not, you know, kind of get pulled into these kind of radical kind of pathways.
So I want to talk about what you just said a little bit more, that it's that white supremacy is embedded in our society. Maybe I'm not characterizing it as what you just said, but what I heard was that it's embedded in our society.
Yes.
And it's embedded in such a way that white people tend to see it as normal and experience it as normal. Is that a good characterization?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely embedded in our society. It's part of the founding of our society. It's part of our collective psyche. It's part of our cultural traditions. It's part of our economic infrastructure. It's part of our political system. I mean, it's there at so many different levels. I think one of the mistakes people have made is that they're not aware of their own privilege in terms of how they benefit from white supremacy. And then they've also, when it comes to more organized, explicit forms of white supremacy, whether we're talking about groups like the Ku Klux Klan or more recent groups like, you know, Adam Often, people kind of, they kind of want to deny that as a problem. They want to minimize it. Say it's just a few people that are out on the fringes and they don't really amount to much. And so we've kind of, despite, I mean, the numbers have been there in terms of like fatalities and violence, the level of violence that these groups commit, you know, and we've just not really addressed it the way we should have. We haven't allocated the resources the way we should have. Since 9/11 in particular, we've tended to treat, you know, basically terrorism as strictly a Muslim problem. You know, we've even had a person run for political office for the highest office of the land who ultimately was elected running on an idea of a Muslim ban, you know, because of how dangerous Muslims are. So, you know, there's been all these diversionary tactics to keep us from really addressing the problem of white supremacy.
So, Akiko, you want to speak to that?
Yes. So for me, as we were meeting in D.C., and I told Pete this shortly after I came home, it was completely different for me to talk about at-risk youth and not be talking about black and brown children. Because generally when we're speaking of black and brown children, it's black and brown children at risk. Well, there aren't white children that are at risk because they can be targeted and their lives can be ruined this way. And by us paying attention to this and targeting it directly, it helps us to help white children and black and brown children who can be targeted by white children who get pulled into white supremacy and nationalism. So it was very heartwarming to see the passion of at the table that I sat around, the people that I sat with that had this passion to stop this, to help these kids, to help all these children, to prevent it from happening.
Mm-hmm.
So March 19th, Arborview High School, when that happened, it's not uncommon to happen in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
It was just uncovered completely and there was a microphone and a spotlight shined on it, and I wouldn't allow it to go away.
Okay, so I want to get to that with you, Pete, also in a second. I want to talk about how the internet amplifies and also maybe hurts the people who want to do these kinds of things. Because if this hadn't been on the internet, you wouldn't have even known it.
Correct.
But I want to go back a little bit to how is it that white kids are pulled into white supremacy?
So, I mean, there's not any one way that it happens. I mean, these are complicated problems, and so they happen for a variety of different reasons. Oftentimes, we want to, explain things in this kind of single dimension. It's one thing that causes it. But what we do know is that oftentimes, individuals who are most kind of likely to join or get involved in these groups tend to be vulnerable in a whole host of different ways. What we see most commonly is certain kinds of social, psychological, kind of emotional vulnerabilities that may result from a variety of different kinds of experiences that an adolescent may have had during childhood or adolescence in terms of certain kinds of family problems, whether it be experiencing physical abuse or sexual abuse. These different kinds of adverse experiences that a child or adolescent may experience create these vulnerabilities, and we're seeing among former members that we've done extensive life history interviews with, we see them reporting much higher levels than you would expect in terms of experiencing physical abuse, sexual abuse, growing up in families characterized with substance abuse, parental neglect. These things in and of themselves don't cause them to become involved in a white supremacist group, but they do kind of set them in a kind of destabilizing way that might make it more likely for them to be able to be recruited in or to find these types of groups attractive in some form. And, of course, now we have the online universe, which there's a whole host of things happening there that, these groups are using to try and recruit you through gaming platforms and so forth and, all set different types of social media platforms.
Okay, so I've got a couple of kids, and I'm white. And I don't think my kids are going to be brought, pulled in by white supremacists. They're pretty smart about this stuff. But what should I look for?
Well, I think the most important thing we can do with our kids, and this is true for all of us, is be having regular conversations about these issues. Mm-hmm. Not just thinking that you're going to see something, but if we have conversations and we're directly talking about these issues and they're starting to kind of move in a particular direction, it's going to come out in how they talk about things, how they express their feelings, how they express their ideas. You'll start to hear things that kind of were like, well, wait a second, where's that coming from? They didn't get that from me. They didn't get it from other members of the family. This is coming from somewhere else online maybe. Maybe they're listening to YouTube videos or something. So I think it's these, and also I think we should be having proactively conversations with our kids much, much earlier about racism, about just race in general, about differences, about diversity, about the fact that differences are something to celebrate, not something to be, fearful of. Or to suppress those conversations. Sometimes parents, I think well-intentioned, don't want to talk with kids about differences that they might notice in terms of skin, color and complexion and so forth. So I think there's a lot of things proactively we could and should be doing differently than we are.
And in D.C., talk to me, Akiko, about the person who you met that Pete characterizes as on the other side, like, sort of the mirror image of you, who has a son who is in jail for doing what was done to your kids.
So him and I, we spent a lot of time really looking at how it affected me and how it affected him. And I was I allowed him to be as transparent as he could be with me. And I had to step aside and say, he actually needs to heal too, because although he's not a victim, his son made him a victim and his wife a victim. And he was very, very adamant as far as wanting to let me know, I didn't raise my son that way. I didn't teach my son that way. But he did take responsibility in saying, but I am responsible because I didn't talk to him about it. I didn't prepare him. as we sat around the table talking, and they're throwing all these words around that are language and terminology in the white supremacist movement, I said, I have to educate myself on what these words are. Because one, me and some of the other guests that were there were like, what are they talking about? What are they talking about? I said, I need a glossary. I need a definition of terms. Because I want to know what they're talking about. And I think it's important that we do know, because that's another way to prevent it if you can talk to your children. Because if your children are online and these things are being said to them, if you know what's being said, then you can step in and say, hey, wait a minute. Because your child can have something on their laptop, a screensaver or a hand signal or anything
right.
But if you don't know what it is, how can you prevent it and how can you step in and talk about it?
Okay, so do you have that glossary of terms? Did you get that?
Not yet.
Okay, fine.
It's a lot. Pete,
do you have a glossary of terms here?
I mean, it's something you pick up as part of, you know, researching it for 20 plus years. It's, I got to tell you, I mean, it's extensive. Of course, it changes over time. New things get developed on an almost daily basis, literally. So nobody has a really exhaustive like list. But the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, does keep a list like this that they offer through their website to help parents, law enforcement, you know, educators, be more aware so that if they see a kid with a lot of Pepe the Frog memes, it's like, well, that looks pretty non-threatening and innocuous, but it's been appropriated by white supremacists. So if a kid's got a bunch of Pepe stuff, that doesn't mean they're a white supremacist, but I'd start asking questions.
I didn't even know that.
You didn't know about Pepe the Frog?
No.
Oh, yeah.
No.
I mean, more recently, it's the okay sign, right, is one.
Right,
that's
the upside-down okay sign.
So that.
But the okay sign, that bothers me, because, like, my mother used to go, okay, you know.
Well, and then I saw it going on social media, and I saw people making fun of it and laughing, and, oh, yeah, whatever. But I just got back from D.C., and I'm going, you better pay attention. Just because it's funny to you or it seems like it can't be possible, it can. Someone can be doing it right in your face. And you wouldn't know.
Right.
For instance, you wouldn't know if you saw a gang hand sign.
Mm-hmm.
You would go,
right.
Oh, no, that's nothing. But it actually is. And it's people communicating right in front of you. But because you don't know that it's problematic.
Interesting. You bring up something that I find on social media. And I can't, unfortunately, keep my mouth shut. But it's the people who say, those white supremacist symbols are right there. The Pepe the Frog is right there. The upside down OK signal or the OK signal at all. I don't even use it at all anymore. Are right there. And you have people say, that's nothing. You're making something out of it that's not there. You're bringing racism into the conversation.
And they're a part of the problem if that's their attitude.
Right. But how do we – but my solution, Pete, is to – is to yell at them. I don't know how to say it in another way. My solution is to say, yeah, that's ridiculous. You're racist. If you think that, you're racist, right? And I don't think that is the best solution. I don't think it will actually move anybody off the needle. What does?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, right? because, you know, we even people who are entrenched in these groups, that needle can be moved. So if people who are deeply committed to, you know, being involved in a white supremacist group and everything that represents in terms of the beliefs and in some cases even being directly involved in violence, if that individual can move, then we know people that maybe are, you know, less steeped in it, then certainly they could be moved. But we don't fully understand exactly how that happens. We know it happens. Actually, people come and go from these groups fairly often. Some people experience very deep changes in how they think and feel in regards to race and religion and sexual orientation and so forth. Others just kind of leave the groups and the beliefs more or less stay intact. So, you know, I think it's, you know, it sounds kind of cliche, but I mean, one thing we know that doesn't work is kind of, yeah, the yelling, because that just escalates and you get more kind of polarization and you get people more deeply entrenched. They dig their heels in, right?
Mm-hmm.
So trying to have a dialogue, if it's possible, is, you know, kind of what we think is going to be most effective, right? And the dialogue's not going to have an automatic, immediate effect, right? But it may plant the seed, right? And that's what you're hoping to do, is to start to plant some seeds in a person who has these kind of beliefs, and that over time, you know, you start to see those walls break down a little bit.
I want to talk about, well, actually, no, I do want to go where I was going to go to begin with. On these social media things, mm-hmm. on these Facebook things, people say stupid stuff, and I say, that's stupid. And I find, and there are black people, mostly black women, who come on, these are like parent groups or mm-hmm. teacher groups, which bothers me a lot. And black women come on and are not quite as direct as I am. And then, you know, may say one or two things and then kind of go away. And I feel like that's because you deal with it all the time. And I'm sitting on the outside and I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. And I don't know quite if I'm just kind of like, you know, pushing the people who could be talking about this away. What do you think?
We are used to dealing with it. We're used to people telling us, get over it. Stop being sensitive. That's not what that meant. Mm-hmm. We're used to it. And a lot of black women are into protecting their peace at this point and not continuously.
Protecting their peace? What does that mean? Just
protecting being at peace. Ah. So yeah. What good is it to argue on social media with people that aren't going to get it? It's more frustrating when we're in the teachers groups and you see teachers that are blatantly racist or who blatantly have no cultural sensitivity at all, that becomes more frustrating. I'm coming from a personal place, so I just go in.
Yeah, I was going to say, you totally go in, much like I do,
and
start arguing with them. Yeah.
Could I qualify something I just said a little while ago, just
sure,
to be
absolutely,
clear?
Absolutely.
Like, I think if we're talking about teachers, that's, you know, I think there's certain populations or audiences, then it's different kind of rules apply. Like if we're talking about teachers, I mean, well, first of all, I should say, I think we absolutely should be clear about what standards are acceptable and unacceptable. And the only way to do that is to, you know, basically voice that, right? Mm-hmm. Because if we were silent about things, then, you know, you can get potential for there to be a perception that things are okay when they're not. So that would be first. And then second, if we're talking about like teachers, for example, I mean, that's something I think you can make an argument about. If they're expressing certain ideas, I mean, I'm not sure that they should even be teaching,
mm-hmm.
you know, without some type of formal intervention.
I want to follow up with that silent comment. This is a quote that I had over my desk for a long time. Our lives begin to end when we are silent about the things that matter. And I believe that was in Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail. I know it came from him, but that's important. And maybe I should channel that to when I'm talking on these Facebook groups. Let's move to white supremacy and how much is it actually on the rise now? And how much is it just that we're noticing it and shining a spotlight on it?
You know, it's both. That's the problem.
Yeah.
The problem, I think, that the issue I have is a lot of people are saying it's just on, like it's new. Like it's a new thing. There's this new problem. Mm-hmm. These white supremacists, where'd they come from? As if it hasn't been a problem all along. So that's, you know, I get really nervous when I hear that because I hear a lot of it. There's definitely an increase in activity, and there's some different things we could look at in terms of fatalities. There's an uptick in fatalities. There's an uptick in just general hate crimes. There's an uptick in, like, school-based activity on college campuses. There's an uptick on K-12 campuses in terms of incidents that seem to be inspired by white supremacist, you know, orientations. So, yeah, there's definitely an uptick. And you saw obviously Charlottesville, you saw this, you know, one of the largest gatherings mm-hmm. of white supremacists yeah. in years. We've had, and then of course all the terror attacks, you know, I mentioned the fatalities, but just I can't underscore that enough. And the manifestos and so forth. And
like
then, of
in
course,
New
you
Zealand,
get into the
and,
online
yes.
universe, and it's just a cesspool in many respects of this kind of stuff. So there's definitely an increase, but the problem, the violence has been there, and the groups have been there, and the beliefs have been there.
It's never gone away. It hasn't gone away, and social media is kind of allowing us to see it more. because it's able to be posted. But then you have social media who they do a lot of filtering of things that happen where we don't hear it or people ignore it. I know, for instance, on my page, I post stuff and people are like, what? When did that happen? And it may have happened 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But it happened. And that's why I post it. It doesn't matter that it's old. It happened. And people need to see that it's happening. And there was an incident very similar to Arborview in South Carolina, I believe. High school. Same thing. And the boy got probation. Like, he didn't even go to jail.
Wow.
And these things are happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not... The story is not being told. It's not being told. It's not being heard of. So then it makes people... It gives people the power to say, that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen in these school districts.
Right. I don't see it.
It is not happening. Who told you that? And I'm like, this child that goes to this school just told me this 10 minutes ago. What are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
I said for the Arborview incident, had those boys not posted those things to Instagram or to social media and they just said it to our sons, teachers would have said, well, how do you know that that happened?
Right. Right. Which brings us back to the double-edged sword of social media, because you saw this on Instagram.
Yes.
And immediately put it out there to other people via social media.
Yes.
And immediately made some phone calls.
Yes.
And then the news media was out there the next morning.
Yes.
And then parents who hadn't seen it came and got their kids.
Yes. It that morning was so scary, because to see those kids running off of campus the way they were, and to see the fright on the parents' faces, and I'm talking about everybody, black, white, blue, brown, pink, yellow, whatever. Kids were scared. Parents were scared. They didn't know what was going on, and that bothered me.
Now, to be clear, what they said on Instagram was, we're going to do a Columbine on these kids.
They
singled out pictures of 9 kids, including your son.
Yes.
All of whom were black.
Yes.
And they said they were going to do a Columbine, which means we're bringing guns into the school and we're going to kill people.
What they said was, we are going to go Columbine part 2, but only killing the N-word. We are going to cleanse the hallways of monkeys and rodents and N-word.
Wow.
That is what they said.
Okay. So
I said, oh, really? Okay.
She's sitting here smiling as she's saying that. I can't imagine she was smiling
I wasn't. Yeah. And the other day, my son, because he did an interview with Teaching Tolerance, and the staff writer said, how do you feel about school? He said, well, I thought school was supposed to be safe.
Mm.
And she said, okay. That's deep.
So we're going to explore that issue of safe in future podcasts, mm-hmm. because I think there's a difference between there's unsafe. I'm afraid that I'm going to be killed, but there's also unsafe in terms of a lot of the teachers that we've run into,
yes.
who don't see racism. So we'll talk about that. I think that's a whole other conversation.
Yes.
I want to look at the other side of that sword, though, Pete, in terms of 4chan and 8chan and things that I don't even know about, where white supremacists are talking and kind of egging each other on. Is there anything we can do to mute that?
Yeah, well, just, it just breaks my heart every time I hear that story tells. But there's a lot of work to be done, and the resources are not really allocated the way they should be. I mean, still the FBI, as much as the FBI tells you they're, you know, taking this seriously, I think it's true to some extent, but the resources are certainly heavily skewed towards international terrorism, Islamic terrorism in particular, and white supremacists, you know, gets, you know, relatively small portion of the resources. There's only so much the FBI can do, given, constitutional issues. If we're talking about public facing, there was a recent arrest related to a Telegram post where somebody on Telegram, white supremacist on Telegram, was giving basically very specific directions about how to make bombs to a person they thought was another white supremacist, but was actually an agent, an FBI agent. So, you know, but it was public facing.
Telegram. Had been, we have to write that one
down. Password protected. Then that would the FBI would not have been allowed to have gone into that. And, of course, a lot of these communication channels are encrypted, and they are password protected. So that's a very difficult one. Obviously, the tech companies have a big role to play here and have been pretty, you know, modest in their efforts, I would say. YouTube continues to be a place where tons of this stuff is accessible in terms of videos, and they you know, do a little here and there in terms of trying to clean that up. But, I mean, it's definitely a very, you know, complex problem.
I want to get to your history a little bit. You embedded yourself in a white power movement. That's something that, as a journalist, I totally admire, and I don't think I would ever have the guts to do. So how did you do that, and why did you do that?
Well, the how is a little bit easier than you might think. You know, I wrote a letter to a P.O. box. This is, you know, like very early days of the Internet. So this is back when P.O. boxes were still widely used. And a lot of these groups had P.O. boxes. So I had gotten a hold of a group through a letter, and they said, you know, they'd be willing to meet with me for lunch, and depending on how it went, then they might be willing to show me the movement. And the lunch worked out okay, and they told me I could come back and I would be able to just stay with them in their homes and not have to get a hotel room. I could just crash in their living room or spare bedroom or whatever. So that's what I started doing. Made contact with a group in northern Idaho as well, Aryan Nations, that had 20 acres of property at the time. And they had a church and everything, and they would hold, you know, national gatherings, even international gatherings. People from Europe would come as well and do cross burnings, swastika burnings, and all that stuff. Wow. You know, I got a hold of them over the phone. They had their church was listed, the Church of Jesus Christ Christian was listed in the directory. And so I called them up and told them that, you know, I wanted to come up and visit. And they said, "Are you white?" And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Well, then you're more than welcome."
Wow.
So some groups were that easy to access. Now, other folks, when they found out I was doing research, did not want any part of me.
So you were open about it. You said, "I'm doing research." You didn't say, "I'm a white supremacist."
No, yeah. So some people at larger gatherings, some people would assume I was just one of them, and I did not disclose that I was a researcher. But if I was like living with people, then they knew I was doing research. You know, they were aware of what I was doing. They were allowing me to essentially embed myself with them. And then in, you know, some situations, then there we'd be around other people, and they wouldn't necessarily know what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And so that was always kind of a dicey situations. I had to figure out when to tell people and when not to. And some people, when I told them, they would immediately get very standoffish and not want to talk to me any further. Mm-hmm. You know? So, but others were very open. You know, I spent time with people, been in and out of prison. I spent time with a person in Southern California, Wade Page, who ultimately, 10 years after the time I spent with him, committed a shooting rampage in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. He walked into a Sikh temple there and opened fire and killed six people, and then ultimately got into a firefight with police and then killed himself. He was somebody, actually one of the persons I spent as much time with as just about anybody in the field. And he was very open to having me around, knew I was doing research. Of course, I had no idea that he would ultimately do what he did. But
did you have to decompress when you came? Like, what was that like for you? Like, therapeutic, like your mental health?
It was very emotionally draining. I had to, in order to build rapport with people, I felt like it was necessary to laugh at jokes that I thought were disgusting, to nod in approval about ideas that the white race was on the verge of extinction, you know, to kind of feign agreement with things that I obviously did not agree with. And so that created a huge amount of guilt and emotional turmoil. And when I would come out of the field, I didn't really notice it, but my wife told me that, you know, she could definitely see how much of a toll it was taking on me. So, I, you know, was fortunate that she was very supportive. I had an advisor whose mother was a Holocaust survivor, and he was very supportive of my research, and was very good about debriefing with me and would talk through, you know, what I was seeing in the field and hearing, and so that helped a lot.
Pete Simi, thank you for talking with us. I'm gonna put you on my Rolodex, and we're gonna interview you in the future.
I'm sharing my friend with you.
Yeah, you're sharing your friend with me.
Pete, thank you so much, though. Seriously,
thanks to both of you for what you do, and it was nice talking with you today.
When you can make it down, we will let you know, because we're starting our monthly town halls. Mm-hmm. So you know, I would love to have you at that. Because we're going into the communities.
We're going into the communities. We're going to talk about race. We're going to talk about intersectionalism. Intersectionality.
Yes.
That's what I meant to say. race and gay and lesbian issues, trans issues, women, and black women and white women, and, you know, all of those kinds of things that we don't necessarily talk about.
Right.
So we're gonna delve into those things and have – it's an education thing. So we're going to talk about how this is – how people have these issues in school, what kids are looking at, and how we change it.
Yes.
Thanks, Pete. I appreciate it.
No.
Thank you, Pete.
Thank you.
I'll talk to you soon.
So, Akiko, I want to talk right now about – what we got coming up October 17th.
Yes.
We are doing our first People's Voice Town Hall Forum at Centennial Hills Library.
Yes.
We're going to be talking about privilege, white privilege, and how you know you have it, and what you can do about it. And we're also going to be talking about some more recent incidents at Arborview. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about that.
So, there was, and I want to say I met with the AP there after this incident. So there was their Spirit Week. And the Spirit Week, along with the Spirit Week, came America Proud Day or something like that, something to that nature. And some of the students took it upon themselves to wear MAGA hats, Make America Great Again hats, and some flags that I was told. So one little Asian girl posted and was told, she said it on her Twitter, Spirit Week at Arborview it was horrible. I wish I wasn't there. She was told, you don't belong in that seat because you don't belong in this country.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't want to come out and talk about it. She's scared. She doesn't know what's going to happen if she's outed, that she's the one who said that. A lot of people said, well, I didn't see that. And I said, well, it doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because you didn't see it doesn't mean it didn't happen. And you're not going to mute this student because it makes you uncomfortable. Imagine how uncomfortable she felt when it was said to her.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have another student who said it. My question was, if it was said in the classroom, where was the teacher?
Good point. And there was this raging, once this came out, there was this raging conversation again on Facebook, and a bit on Twitter about they were just showing their pride in America. They were, they were just wearing a MAGA hat. Why were you offended by a MAGA hat? And one of the things I found, though, there are teachers out there who wear MAGA hats or who would like to wear MAGA hats. They're not allowed to wear them to school.
Right.
Or MAGA T-shirts or whatever, right? Kids aren't allowed to wear hats to school, too. So if somebody actually was wearing a hat, that's a problem. But if it was a T-shirt, there's that disconnect with people looking at that and absolutely seeing that as racist.
Well, look at the message that it stands behind. So, first of all, I need to know, when was America ever great for black and brown people?
Oh, yeah.
I need to know that if we want to make America great again. When was it ever great for black and brown people, aside from maybe when Black Wall Street was up and running and we were independent? And then in Tulsa, Oklahoma, a bomb was dropped on Black Wall Street.
Right.
Okay, well, there then went that.
Maybe Reconstruction. Maybe like the 9 years of Reconstruction after the Civil War.
Maybe.
Right.
But, I mean, we were still being lynched.
Mm-hmm.
You know, black and brown people were still being lynched. So I don't know when America was great for us. And it's hard for... That makes white people uncomfortable when we say that. And I'm like, why are you uncomfortable? You aren't enduring it. I am.
Mm-hmm.
Are you uncomfortable because you think I'm calling you racist? It's a conversation. We have to talk about it at some point. So where was it great for us? So what does that mean when a brown child sees a MAGA hat and her cousin or her aunts and uncles have been deported or they're sitting in ICE? because of Make America Great Again.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of trauma is that? Has it made for this student or this child? That's why MAGA is uncomfortable
mm-hmm.
for us. I mean, so, and it's a political statement. It shouldn't be on a campus.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
Totally agree. I also feel like, and we're going to have administrators from our review there, yes?
Yes.
Okay,
so
Kiko's in charge of, like, you know, making this happen. It's been crazy for me. But one of the things I like, it feels like a real mistake to have done in this atmosphere an American Proud Day.
So, I was given what the actual week was, and the biggest problem that they admit was the cowboy theme week, the cowboy theme.
Mm.
And I said, well, it didn't have to be uncomfortable if that was the case, because there are black cowboys.
Right.
So you could have included the black cowboys. There's a black rodeo every year in Compton, California. There are black cowboys still here.
And there were black cowboys 100 years ago,
yes,
and 150 years ago, people who had escaped slavery,
yes,
and came west.
Yes. So that was a time to educate. That was a time to educate on the word cowboy and what it's connected to. And there are still black cowboys.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the theme itself wasn't necessarily meant to be that way, but it was enough to give students the opportunity to say what they had been wanting to say. Now, let me be clear. What you do at home, in your garage, on your street, is your personal business. But when you step on a school campus, you have to leave that where you got it from. It's not welcomed, and it shouldn't be welcomed by anyone. And I think that the culture has brewed for so long that these kids just cope with it.
Mm.
It's just how it is. And I'm not okay with that. And I actually only have 4 more years in the district, because I have a ninth grader. She graduates in 4 years, but I'm not stopping there, because we got 10 plus years. So that means I probably have 30 plus years of work to do, and I'm already kind of old. So,
okay, I want to get to another topic. This is one of the things I want to do every month when we're talking about this stuff,
mm-hmm,
is exposing the hidden history of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are, like, just a moment ago, we were talking about black cowboys,
yes,
which a lot of people don't know we have ever had and still have.
Right.
So give me an example of something that is the hidden history that people don't know about.
Okay. So we got Moses West. It's not necessarily history yet, but it will be hidden history, the hidden history of the United States, because it's not just black history. It's our history. It's the United States history.
Mm-hmm.
Moses West has created a machine that makes water from air. And he has supplied Puerto Rico, the Bahamas, and Flint, Michigan already to fix the water problem.
He makes water from air.
From air. And it's filtered. It's drinkable. And it's approved by the federal government.
Wow. That sounds totally biblical.
I mean, the article said there's God standing right here in front of you. Like,
So Moses West,
yes,
is some sort of engineer and,
yes,
and created this thing to purify drinking water,
yes,
and testing it out in the Midwest. I found it interesting that you said this will be hidden history. This is happening now.
Yes.
But you're sure that this is going to be hidden.
It will be hidden history. There are so many inventions of blacks that are not attributed and said a black person invented this. I think the one thing that whites have invented was the patent office. So... we have all these inventions that we have actually contributed to society. And while we're always being told, go back to Africa. So if we take our inventions and go back to Africa with our inventions, what is America going to do?
Okay, we're going to look at many of those inventions.
Yes.
And also things that people have done to change. They're not necessarily an invention, but,
right,
but things they've done to change.
And
history.
I want to say that it's important to know, because it lifts black children and brown children up to where we aren't just stuck in slavery. Oh, your ancestors were slaves. We were so much more than mm-hmm. that. And it gives people a vision of everything that we are capable of. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, we are capable of so many things, so intelligent, and that's taken from us because our history becomes hidden. And they'll say, like, for this story, it just says a Texas man.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
So that's one of the things, though, as a journalist, uh-huh. I don't want to say a black man from
True.
Texas,
True.
Right?
I mean,
he's a
that.
Texas man.
Yeah.
But yes, I do agree that it lifts black and brown children up to hear this, but it also helps me and
yes.
my children and other white people to go, oh, I didn't realize this. I remember an episode of MASH, and this is going to date me. I remember an episode of MASH in which the point of the episode was to let us know mm-hmm. that the guy who invented open heart surgery
yes.
was a black man.
Yes.
And as a kid watching that, I was like, whoa.
Well, white supremacy makes black people to be barbaric and violent. It makes us to be less than human. So to hide all of the inventions that we have actually come up with shows that, no, we're very much human. We very much operate at a mm-hmm. high level. We're not barbaric. We're not just violent. Like, that's not what that is. So it's very important to show that we are inventors and that we do add to society a
mm-hmm.
lot, things that you need.
Mm-hmm. And
the
things
stoplight.
That we don't know
I mean,
about.
Just
the stoplight.
The
I know.
Stoplight.
Okay, so we'll talk about that in the next episode or
yes.
another episode.
Yes.
And we're going to be calling this particular episode Exposing the Hidden History of the United States. Akiko Cooks, thanks for being here.
Oh, absolutely. I'm looking forward to all the great work we're going to do.
And me too. Nevada Voice is a nonprofit running under the fiscal sponsorship of the Moon Ridge Foundation. Please consider becoming a monthly member to support us. At NevadaVoice.org. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Thank you for listening to the Nevada Voice Podcast.